Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, as always, by, or in most weeks anyway, by the man behind Danwei.org, the Financial Times Company, the one and only Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, how are you?
I'm very well. Good evening, Kaiser.
I neglected to share with our listeners last week that you've been shorn. Where, my friend, is your lovely Jufro?
It's lying on the bottom of a Russian barber in Auckland, New Zealand.
Oh, my God.
Brutal.
Well, okay, so he looks nothing like the picture on our Facebook page right now. It's good on you, man. I could get used to this.
You know, this is supposed to be like radio. I don't want people knowing what I look like.
You have a face for radio. Okay, so...
And put those clothes back on.
Well, you don't... Okay, so to the show. Okay, so... beware the Ides of March. That is an injunction that companies, Chinese, foreign, and domestic, should take very seriously. So March 15th is World Consumer Rights Day, and in China, where this is very taken very seriously, companies and consumers alike have come to expect that China's media, its state media, usually with CCTV leading the charge, are going to single out a company, sometimes more than one, for alleged crimes against the Xiaofeizhe, for fleecing Chinese consumers, much as the way some Russian barber in New Zealand did to Jeremy's curly locks. Anyway, this time, like William Tell, if he'd had a scope mounted on his crossbow, China's state media had Apple in its crosshairs. We'll talk about Consumer Day and what the Cupertino-based tech giant to which I have handed over much of my family's hard-earned guilder. Allegedly, what Apple allegedly did to so incense state media on this. Apple CEO Tim Cook's apology, other possible reasons for the attacks, and of course, what the lessons that companies, especially multinationals, might learn from this whole episode. So with us to talk about this are two eminently qualified individuals. Making her debut here on Cynica is Lori Burkett, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Lori's beat is the consumer market here in China, and she's been working with the journal's excellent tech reporter, Paul Moser, on a piece about Apple that I think it's going to run Friday. Is that right?
Yeah, it should be running pretty soon.
We're hoping. So right around the time. So anyway, welcome to Cynical, Lori.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here. Inaugural event.
Hey, excellent. Okay, also joining us in the studio is David Wolf, China Supremo for PR agency Allison and Partners, longtime China business veteran and frequent guest on Cynical. Welcome back, David.
It's great to be here as always, Kaiser.
Good to see you, man. So let's jump right in and talk first about World Consumer Rights Day, which was first observed in 1983, says the Wikipedia story on this. Anyway, growing up in the States, even with my dad being an avid subscriber to Consumer Reports magazine, I was just never aware that March 15th had any significance at all. But in China, it has taken on pretty extraordinary significance. And in my working life here, I have come to know it as the day when companies quake in their corporate boots. So when did Consumer Rights Day become such a big deal in China, Dave?
It's grown over the years. And essentially, it started out very early in the 90s where China began picking it up. Because remember, in China, it's the companies that come first, not the consumers. The government wants to support the companies and let them grow. So consumers always kind of wind up with what's left over. You can see that in the interest rates we get in our banking, but you can see it across the board. And so one day a year, the government wants to stand up and prove, yes, we're standing up for the consumers. It was interesting. In the 90s, it really wasn't such a big deal. But as foreign companies really began to sort of gain traction in China, and as we move towards a more consumer-driven society in the last decade, every year it seems like the volume has been ratcheted up. So we've been quaking in our boots, I know, since about 2002 when in my business, in public relations, we really started watching it. But it just seems like every year it's more intense.
So is it always multinational companies that are targeted? I mean, what are some of the other companies that have found themselves on the receiving end of state media's ire?
Well, many times it is multinational companies, at least in recent years. So if you look at 2010, you saw Hewlett-Packard. If you look at 2011, I think we had McDonald's
right.
Last year, right? And we also had Carrefour. And this year, of course, Apple was the lucky one. But that doesn't mean that some of the domestic companies haven't also been targets. This year, there was NetEase. I think Sina was also mentioned on that. And, they do make it a somewhat even playing field.
Wasn't there a process food company this year as well?
Not Shuanghui, but one of the other ones?
There were pharmaceutical companies mentioned. I can't recall them.
There are a clutch of local companies, not just multinationals.
But this year in the two-hour program that actually ran on CCTV, Apple and Volkswagen seem to have been come in for it in the main, and Apple especially, right?
Yeah, it was the main target. Of course, that's the splashy one worldwide anyway, though. All eyes are always on Apple.
Right. I mean, maybe they figured out that all they need to do to get hits is put Apple in the title. Okay, so those of us who didn't see the show, and I would have to include myself, unfortunately. Lori, can you provide some color about the show itself? I mean, I've read some of what you've written about it. I mean, we don't need to get into specific allegations. We're going to do that later on. But tell us about the show. I mean, it was quite a lavish production.
Yeah,
it?
I mean, this is sort of in terms of the consumer, it's a consumer rights gala. So something that we might see even for Spring Festival. It's very similar to the Chun one. But they make sort of a game show out of it. In the run-up to the actual show, they had a big online production that you could send in your comments to CCTV. You could post things on Weibo. So I had actually been following it, thinking I would get a good sense of what consumers were really saying about companies. And perhaps even be able to predict ahead of time which ones would be targeted. And I looked at comments on Weibo, and I have to tell you that prior to the actual show, there really wasn't much indication that Apple would be targeted at all. But going back to your question, Kaiser, the event itself was really quite a spectacle. And my editor let me have a lot of fun with it and fill in a lot of color, because we're talking about song and dance about consumer rights. And they had, they had these little musical troupes. It was like watching Glee, but the lyrics to the songs that they're singing are about like taking back the power into the consumer's hands. So it was just a lot of fun and singing to Journey's Don't Stop Believing.
Which made it more like Glee.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Oh my God. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I really wish I had seen it.
No, yes, next year we got to get tickets. I mean, it's worth going to.
Any idea what the viewership is like for a show like this?
I really tried quite hard to find precise viewership numbers, but wasn't able to find any, so they don't break it down like that.
Okay. So, David, tell us as a PR vet what it's like for companies in China and for their PR agencies in the weeks leading up to March 15th every year since 2002. You said quaking in the boots, but is it like war room?
It really depends. There are some companies that just come into the season in denial. They don't believe that they're going to be the ones targeted. Usually these things will come out of the blue. So in most cases, they won't know. If there's been a quality problem during the year, those are the companies that tend to prepare a little bit better. But everybody in every agency is picking up the phone as early as the beginning of Chunjie, of Chinese New Year, saying, listen, we've got 3/15 coming up, so are we ready? We're preparing contingency plans. We're getting messages ready. We're getting holding statements ready. Getting
big
Q&A
fat envelopes ready.
Yeah, seriously. And putting the U.S. on alert and making sure the investor relations people are all ready to go and they're informed. And quite often it turns into, if you'll pardon the expression, a Chinese fire drill. But from that perspective, better to be safe than sorry is the way that we play it. I'm sure that Apple was caught flat-footed on this one. I think of all the different companies in China, they didn't expect to get nailed with this.
Well, really? I mean, well, why not? I mean, there had been warning signs, hadn't there been? I mean, didn't they get sort of taken to task a couple of times some months ago over the very issues that were brought up on the show? That is, using refurbished parts in iPhone 4 and 4S's that had been returned. And not having a warranty policy that was sort of up to Chinese standard.
I think there were probably some concerns among the more experienced people at Apple here in China. Apple did something very interesting when they expanded here in China. They went and scooped up some of the best PR communications and marketing people in the business, and they brought them in. The problem, of course, Apple's great strength is the way that they centrally control the company. And the way that all kind of radiates out from Cupertino. Their great weakness in this case was the centralization of the company.
Right.
Exactly. As it is with so many companies, their great weakness is rooted in their strength. And this was, I think, the problem here was that they weren't getting a lot of listen back. And even the people here in China who were raising their hands say, guys, we should probably be ready, weren't getting a lot of response and preparedness, which is why they looked like they were caught flat-footed.
Yeah, I've heard that, they kind of – I mean, here on the ground, I've just sort of heard through the grapevine that there were a lot of warnings sent to Cupertino about this. Laura, you're nodding your head.
I've heard the same thing and talked to a couple of sources who said they were given fair warning as much as 2 months in advance. And if you kind of look at it, I mean, this is a huge company and it's completely centralized. And it's not likely that they would have been able to have responded as quickly as they did. I mean, it was hours after that they came out with a response. So without the prior preparation, I'm not sure if they would have been able to have done that. It doesn't mean their response was the right one, but they did have one, right?
Mm. And there's another aspect to all this, and that is in Apple itself, there is a clear hierarchy among the subcultures within the organization. The people who are the product designers sit at the top. The engineers sit below them. The operations guys who handle all the manufacturing sit below that, and so on and so on. And down at the very bottom of that Chinese-like hierarchy of professions are the marketing and communications people. And that certainly has to have some sort of effect on the degree to which people like Tim Cook are listening to his advisors.
Excuse me, I have to stifle myself from crying because of the familiar.
No, I'm sure that doesn't happen at other tech companies.
That never happens at tech companies in China. Jeremy, let's talk about the popular reaction to the CCTV attacks. I mean, there were some bungled moves in this campaign. I mean, the campaign.
Well, the first thing which we were talking about earlier was that Peter Ho, the aptly named Peter Ho, a Hong Kong actor, tweeted about how mad he was about Apple mistreating Chinese consumers, and he neglected to delete the post at 8:20 tag that his handlers had given him. So people immediately speculated that there were a bunch of celebrities who'd been paid to attack Apple, either by CCTV or by Samsung, was the other speculation that I heard. And this caused a bit of a backlash against CCTV. But there was also a lot of people who had reactions along the lines of, so CCTV, you don't care about the dead pigs floating down the river in Shanghai. You don't care about the fact that we're all dying of emphysema in Beijing because of PM2.5. But you care about the cost of a product that a lot of Chinese people really love. And, you know, some stuff that no consumers really seem to care about.
Would you say the preponderant, the majority of people who opined on this issue were pro-Apple?
You know, I think that was certainly the loudest people. The loudest people and the most influential people were, if not pro-Apple, certainly anti-CCTV. But that is the, I mean, you know, on Weibo, that is, I mean, it is kind of an anti-CC. I mean, this is the place where you call CCTV CCAV. In other words, like a pun on AV porno movies. So on Weibo, one does tend to see people rather critical of CCTV.
Right. But I guess the question in my mind is does that matter? Did it matter that popular opinion was anti-CCTV and sort of pro-Apple by default? Did that afford Apple any kind of useful cover?
Well, if I may, I think our two guests perhaps are best qualified to answer this. But I have a thought about this, which is that I think that the fact that Apple's warranty, you know, stuff isn't covered by warranty, that it's expensive to have the phone repaired, that's not going to harm Apple's sales. You only buy an iPhone to impress people that you spent 5,000 yuan on a phone.
I mean, that's the whole. It's a pretty good.
Well, it's a good phone, but I mean, the to me, the main reason. And it's done so well in China because a lot of people aren't addicted to the App Store. They aren't addicted to podcasts. A lot of the stuff that people in other countries really need on the iPhone isn't necessarily what people want it for here. I mean, I know it's a good phone, but it's a very expensive phone. So being more expensive, I mean, it's like a Louis Vuitton bag. You don't want it too cheap. So I don't know really if this is going to harm its relationship with consumers at all. But what I do think is that if the government, and if you can read CCTV as, you know, a proxy for other, you know, parts of the government, if they're starting to get annoyed at Apple, then there's problem coming down the line, not because consumers are going to be annoyed about the warranty or, you know, some other bullshit that CCTV covered.
Right. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? Did it afford Apple any cover or did it?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, did it afford Apple cover from the government? Absolutely not. What this did was by bringing about a reaction against CCTV, what the party interpreted, I believe, was that it was a slur on the credibility of the party's mouthpiece. And therefore, somebody picked up the phone, called CCTV and said, guys, you've got a choice. You can either back off or you can double down. You're not backing off.
Right.
Okay. And which is when the People's Daily then got into the mess as well in a supporting role. And that so I think that from a government relations and a party relationship standpoint, it afforded no cover. But an interesting thing happened here. What we haven't seen developed to date in China is a rabid, semi-organized band of Apple fanboys emerge in the same way that we've got it in the United States, in Europe, and in Japan.
Thank God.
But what we started to see was the birth of that. When we start looking at some of those Weibo posts, for the ones that are pro-Apple, they are fanboy wild Apple. That has to be a great thing for Apple to look out and see.
So they like to see the brand sort of galvanize people.
That's it. I mean, in the old days when I was a fanboy, what galvanized us was Microsoft, IBM, and you know the fact that Windows was a straight up knockoff of the Apple operating system, and that's what made us such militants. I mean, we've got a tiny little market share, but by God, we're Apple people. They've never had that in China.
What is Apple's market? I mean, if I were to limit myself to, you know, first tier cities and just haunting the upscale cafes, I would guess Apple's market share to be way out of whack to what it in fact is. I mean, you go into a Starbucks and all you see are people with MacBook Pros open and, you know, with iPads and I mean, you don't. That's not what you see on the subway. Of course, it's not what you see. You know, in Fengtai District or in second tier cities, but do you, David, do you have a sense of where Apple is in the market?
The most recent numbers I've seen are that of smartphones,
okay.
Which are now increasingly are becoming the majority of phones in the market. Apple has a 15% market share.
Right.
That's down considerably from about a 70% market share. Understandable, given the fact that we now have all kinds of alternatives in the market. But it's been a steep drop for them. They are, in fact, now number six in the market.
Mm-hmm. And I looked yesterday. You know, China accounted for 15% of Apple's revenue last year, which is pretty big. And
yeah,
it's enough that now that they're breaking out the revenue on earnings every quarter now, and we'll be able to see the growth and how much maybe Apple is taking a hit from this very issue. Because we did see this is going back to your did they get any cover question. I'm really not sure what to make of that because I think we have to be careful sometimes when we're looking at Weibo. We get a very self-selected pool of people who may actually already open. You know, they may all own Apple iPhones, and I think you know it's the consumers perhaps who don't already own iPhones that may be affected by this. And we certainly saw with KFC in December that here's a Yum Brands took a major hit.
Can you remind listeners of the circumstances?
Sure. There? So back in November, some local media started reporting that there was a story about Quick Chickens and KFC and how the company was using suppliers that were trying to grow chickens quickly with the help of antibiotics. And then CCTV picked up on this in December and started looking at how KFC had been using suppliers and some issues that it had with a probe in Shanghai. Actually, last year, this took off like wildfire on Weibo, and KFC. You know, many people said they just didn't respond well to this on Weibo. They weren't able to quell a lot of the conversation. And the sales in the fourth quarter actually took a dive, 6%, which is pretty big. I mean, this is for Yum Brands in China. And then I was looking yesterday, I think 41% down at KFC stores in January.
I'm sure the avian flu thing is not going to help either.
Yeah.
No, and keep in mind, this is China represents 40% of the profits of Yum Brands on a year-to-year basis.
Their stock price took a serious hit from that. But I do think it's a little different from Apple because, I mean, who wants to eat poisonous chickens? Whereas, I mean, what, you know, your phone That's back right. breaks and you have to pay an extra bit of money for it. I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's the same fear. I mean, I am scared of food problems in China,
I
personally, you know, and stories like that put me off. But I mean, a little bit of extra money for a broken phone back, is that going to really dent people's enthusiasm for a great product?
Yeah, you're not eating Apple.
Yeah.
There's a bite taken out of it. Yeah. David, I have a question for you. Jeremy mentioned the App Store, the iTunes Store, and how that actually isn't a service. I mean, they're not selling a lot of apps. They're not selling a lot of music or movies into China. And many people have raised this as one of the potential issues for Apple down the road, that the walled garden it represents one of sort of the last uncensored pieces of you know, the potential inroad into China. Well, first of all, give us a little. I mean, I'm not sure our listeners outside of China have a sense for what then do people actually do with their phone. I mean, where do they get apps? Where do they get music on their phones?
It's important to keep in mind that the iPhone came to China through the gray market channel. The only reason that Apple started actually investing so much money in marketing and in building stores here was that 9 months after the introduction of the iPhone, or 9 months after the iPhone went on sale, they did a check on all the networks and they realized that 750,000 of these phones, between 750,000 and a million, had just disappeared from the network. And when they did a check, they discovered, oh, there they all are in China, and they've been bricked. Yeah. And so essentially during the period of time between that revelation and about a year and a half later, when Apple really negotiated everything and started to sell phones in China, originally through value-added resellers, there was a period of time where people here had to figure out what they were going to do for apps. And so we had a whole series of domestic stores popping up that sold music and that sold apps, either apps that were developed locally or apps that were being brought in or imported through other means. And so people got used to using alternative app stores.
Cydia and that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. Now, that said, one of the interesting things that's happened is the statistics that I've seen is on average, your average iPhone owner in the United States will download between 18 and 20 apps. In China, it's 6.
Hmm.
And part of that reason, I think, is because on the Apple side, people are used to paying for it in the States, and the developers used to charging for it. It's a better product, theoretically, than Android. I would argue against that. It's not necessarily true. But they're just not using it for it, which supports Jeremy's point, which is one of the primary reasons that people have been buying iPhones here is the shy factor. They want to show people that they've got it. It's phone bling every bit as much as the Razr was for Motorola back 6 years ago. And so it just happens to be the current phone bling. The challenge there then for Apple is, where's the lock-in, guys?
Right. We've sold them the Razr. Where how are we gonna, you know, keep selling them?
And if they don't want to buy the blades because they got the Razr,
right?
Where
but
are we?
If we can go back to what I think you were heading for, Kaiser, the question of content and censorship. I mean, I think that it is an incredible Trojan horse trick they've managed to pull off, because I mean, the stuff you can get on an iPhone now through the Apple App Store is, you know, stuff that hasn't been approved. I mean, there's a lot of content that hasn't been approved by any regulator.
Yeah, but yet. I mean, it's not like there's a Tank Man app or there's like a Free Tibet app or I mean, what are we really talking about here in terms of content that's dangerous or subversive?
Well, you can get books and podcasts and movies and you can get periodicals. I mean,
sure,
okay, some things,
sure.
You know.
All of it in English.
Yeah. Well, isn't it even more than that?
Chinese.
I mean, the ability to communicate through apps, right? And I think that's sort of a scary thing that you wouldn't be able to measure. And if it's Weixin and if it's a company that you've got within, you know, your reach, then you can control that. But if it's a WhatsApp that then becomes popular here instead, I think that's a scarier idea, right?
That's
right.
Scary. But I mean, the content itself, today, this guy on Weibo, whose name I'm just, I follow, I think it's Tiny Fool, was tweeting that on Weibo that an app he used to download books has been removed from the Apple App Store. And he thinks it's been censored by Apple. And because, you know, there's some banned or censored of books on this App Store. So, I mean, I think it is a real concern for Apple, and maybe the government doesn't know yet, but they will soon. And I think this is going to get a lot of trouble for Apple, because they're going to have to censor their content, and then they're going to be noticeably censoring it, and it's going to bring them the same world of pain the other companies have had to do, the American companies
right,
have had heaped on them.
This censorship is or the potential for censorship, is it's one of the reasons that have been floated that maybe we should now enumerate for what really lay behind this CCTV, the state media attack in the first place. If we were to lay out the kind of prevalent theories, where would we start? Okay, I guess there's this whole theory that this is in some sense retaliation for the way that Huawei and ZTE have been ill-used by the U.S. Congress and sort of kept out of that market. David, do you think there's anything to that?
I think that there's part of it. I think it's a series of complex reasons. Anytime you have the government ganging up like this, either you have one overwhelming reason or you have enough reasons that you've got a large enough contingent of people in the government who will say, yeah, for whatever my particular reason is, let's go after those guys. Yeah.
Okay, so that's one reason. A second is, I guess I'll clump these two together, sort of industrial policy, that this is led by MIIT, that this is part and parcel of this whole attack on the Android operating system and its dominance in the market, that this is, you know, the same thing. This is maybe a tacit signal that, guys, Chinese champions, step up, develop operating systems, you know, get into this hardware game in a serious way also. And linked to that, of course, is sort of trade protectionism.
Soft protectionism is definitely a part of it. You know, it's funny. If you look back on the history of the computer industry in China over the last 15 years, you see one incident after another every 3 to 5 years where the leading supplier of laptops or computers gets itself into trouble with the consumers writ large in China, and they lose that position. If you look back to 2001, remember Toshiba?
Sure.
So Toshiba made a little error because they weren't covering Chinese consumers to the same degree that they were covering U.S. consumers on a recall. That created a backlash. The government encouraged that. Toshiba evaporated from its market leadership role in laptops.
That was one of the very early lessons. I remember that.
Very early lessons. And then 2006, same thing happened to Dell Computer. Summer of 2006, I remember we had this thing where some little spec about a processor was written incorrectly in an advertisement and on the box.
And we had Dellgate, and we had processor gate.
We had processor gate for Dell. Dell never recovered from that in their market share here. And then, of course, as Laurie brought up, in 2010, the same thing happened to HP. Interestingly enough, HP was the market share high flyer right behind Lenovo at the time. And HP has now taken a gigantic hit. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there's clearly a pattern here.
Actually, this is the first time that I've heard this laid out like that. I mean, it really does make quite a bit of sense.
And now here you have Apple. Not only are they the tallest reed, but whether they're the market share leader or not, they're conspicuous, and they get up and they thump their chest and they say, we are making X billion dollars a year in this market. Big, fat, hairy mistake. You don't stand up and wave in the face of the Chinese people and government that you're making a fortune here.
It's a red cape, or it's a target on their back.
It's a target on their back. You bow, you scrape, you say, we feel privileged to be here. You know, we don't break out our numbers for this territory. That's always the good kind of PR out, right?
Right.
We don't break out numbers by territory, but we're really happy with our results in the market, and we're grateful to be here. Apple never did that. Apple got up in front of everybody in New York and said, yes! Look at all the money we're making over there. And that,
now we're going to make more.
Now we're going to make more.
Tim Cook, right, himself told Xinhua, he said, China's going to be our biggest market.
They are the tallest reed, and we all know what happens to the tallest reed in China.
That's right.
We do indeed.
Well, also, you know, on that note, I was talking to Jim McGregor yesterday, and he said China loves companies that come in and they give them something. They want technology transfer. Apple is making money for Apple. Apple is not giving back to China. Mm. And so, you know, that's something that we may – if suddenly we notice that they're doing all these corporate social responsibility campaigns in China, perhaps we'll know what's going on.
Well, interesting. I want to circle back to Jim McGregor in just a second, but I want to finish our little list of potential reasons. I guess the one that I've left out is the shakedown theory. I mean, we've seen this happen before where, I mean, CCTV goes after a company. All they need to do is buy a little ad time in their most expensive slot, you know, the Chunhua. and all the troubles disappear. Do you think there's anything to that this time? I mean, I personally don't think this was a case of a shakedown, but I mean, it was too elaborately orchestrated for that.
What we're hearing through the grapevine, and you'll never hear the CCTV advertising department admit this, but they're starting to feel the squeeze of online video.
Mm-hmm. Of course they are.
They're starting to lose viewership. And more importantly, you have a falling number of major advertisers who are ready to say, well, nobody ever got fired by buying ads on CCTV. People are actually looking for effectiveness now in growing numbers. And you have the big the big media agencies who aren't pushing people towards CCTV anymore. Right. So I wouldn't put a little element of the blackmail past them, but I don't know that that necessarily was the issue either for Apple or for Volkswagen, which was the other big foreign company they went after.
Just a possible side benefit.
A possible side benefit, exactly. Okay. Make it easier for the
So, I mean, our conclusion is that it's a little of each. It's a little bit of the retaliation.
I think also you should add what you said at the beginning of the show, Kaiser, which is that Apple is a great – I mean, if you're a media, you want people to watch, and attacking Apple is – you know, it'll bring eyeballs and hits, right?
Right, even if they're the wrong kind of eyeballs. I promised we'd get back to Jim McGregor, and I wanted to put this question to Laurie and to David and Jeremy too. I mean, so you know, Jim once described in his book 1 Billion Customers, he described the Chinese media landscape as a free fire zone for multinationals. That you're always going to you're the easiest target, and you know there's little cost to go after an MNC over a domestic Chinese company. Has that changed? Is that still the case?
Hasn't changed at all, and I've got an article going up either on Silicon Hutong or Foreign Policy tomorrow. If Foreign Policy spikes it, I'll put it up on the blog. That's basically saying the same thing. And I wanted to title it, you know, if you're coming to China, bring your knee pads. But I didn't think that would go over too well.
Spittoon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the issue is this: if you leave yourself even slightly exposed, you are the easiest target. You know, we have this saying in Chinese, which roughly translated is, you know, kill a chicken to teach a monkey.
Right.
And well, if it's a white chicken, that blood shows off much more vividly, okay, when you kill the chicken. And so, and that's what they do. Is this is a process of you know, A, teaching the locals, okay, guys, we're going to come after you. See, we went after the big foreigners first. But the implication is we're coming after you if you don't shape up. The other thing is that the government looks like they're being very helpful in protecting the consumers. But the third thing is they also get to yank the foreigners down a notch by all of this. And that's why the foreigners are in a free fire zone. We just don't have the kind of political cover that the local enterprises, especially the state-owned, have. But here's something very interesting. If you look at that whole group of companies this year's show that were Chinese,
mm-hmm.
there was a significant percentage of those companies that were not state-owned.
Right.
Hmm.
Okay.
They never go after state-owned enterprises.
No, they don't.
Right, right. And so again, whether this whole campaign is about going after foreign companies or whether it's just about going after everybody but the state-owned, except in the most egregious circumstances, it's probably more accurate to say that it's we're pulling back the competition for the state-owned enterprises.
Interesting.
Well, I think in general, they do want to even the playing field. If you're looking at the goal of the economic shift here, it's to create a consumer-led economy, right? And if your strongest players are the foreign ones and you're creating an economy that benefits the foreign players, what's the point of doing this? I mean, they want a strong national companies to emerge out of
sure.
all of this.
But the question is do you get strong national companies by coddling and protecting and grabbing those guys by the – yanking them back by the collar, grabbing the foreigners and yanking them back by the collar, or do you get the strong foreign companies in the way that Zhu Rongji wanted to get them, which is
– Let them compete.
Let them compete. And then whatever comes out of here will be the best. Zhen Jin Bu Pa Huo Lian, right? True gold fears no fire. Mm-hmm. Let's find those true gold Chinese companies.
Great. I just want to quickly wrap because we're running out of time and I still want to get to recommendations. But David, just to wrap up, give us your assessment. How did Apple handle the whole thing? I mean, was Tim Cook smart to apologize? Did he have a choice?
Tim Cook was right to apologize. He should have done it 2 weeks earlier.
Okay.
By delaying and by allowing this to become a bigger issue than it otherwise would have, by not pouring water on the fire, he allowed this to turn into a conflagration. I put that right smack on the people in Cupertino.
Laurie, what about you? Do you think
Yeah, same thing here. I mean, just looking at how companies in the past have dealt with this, last year, McDonald's and Carrefour apologized immediately. It was done. It was over at the end.
Disappeared quickly.
Yeah, this year we saw KFC, Yum Brands, they waited also to apologize.
Yep.
And so did Apple. And, it, you know.
So grovel quickly, grovel often.
Get on your knees.
Get on your knees. And Jeremy, let's quickly go around takeaways, the big takeaways. I mean, David's already enumerated a couple of them, but let's – What are some of the big takeaways?
My only takeaway is if you're buying Apple stock because you think they're going to make billions and billions and billions and billions in China, reconsider your reasons for buying Apple stock.
Well, they still got me buying their shit. I'm not saying
they won't make billions elsewhere, but if Apple thinks China is going to be their biggest market and is going to be give them growth that the rest of the world can't give them, I think that there's quite a lot of risk in that strategy.
Okay. David, do you want to add anything more than you've already you've given us many pearls of wisdom here?
The level playing field is coming, so Apple's just the first in the barrel.
Okay. Lori?
I'm going to go back to the get on your knees. We are learning that being apologetic is incredibly valuable here in this market. I think that's the strong takeaway.
The efficacy of apology. That's Well, great. Let's move on now to the section of the podcast where we make recommendations. Okay, so we're going to start recommendations with Lori.
Okay, so recently, for those of you who do not have ovens, listeners who don't have ovens, your rice cooker can actually do a lot more than you think it can. I have recently baked brownies in the rice cooker. I have baked a cake there. I've discovered that online there are plenty of YouTube and other videos to show you how to cook multiple. You can bake bread in your rice cooker.
Wow, I have an oven, but I'm one of those lucky few expats who lives in an apartment that actually came equipped with a good oven. It is a rare thing, right? I mean, it's still pretty rare to have ovens. And Jeremy, do you remember when we didn't live in sort of hoity-toity housing and
yes,
those days.
No, not really.
Did it not bake good.
Suddenly, I feel very humble.
Mr. My company got bought by the FT. David, you're up. That's a great suggestion, Lori. I mean, thanks. That's a great one. It's very novel.
I'm reading an oldie but a goodie, Red Capitalism, superb book. And the reason I picked it up was because I wanted to go and pick up China's Superbank and realize that if I didn't read Red Capitalism first, I would probably be completely lost.
The author?
Oh, gosh. Forget it right off the top of my head. But okay. you can Amazon it or Google it. It's available on your Kindle.
I mean, that's an oldie. I mean, that's like 2002, right?
It was 2008. They updated it. They did a second edition in 2010. So it makes a perfect companion for the China Superbank. And you know, even for those of you, and I'm certainly not a finance person, but for those of you who are mystified by what's happening in China's financial world, this is going to make a lot of things clear, and it's certainly going to leave you scratching your heads wondering, my God, how did it all hold together for so long?
I wonder that every day. Jeremy, what do you have for us?
Two essays basically about young Chinese people post-80s, one by Alec Ash and one by James Palmer. I'll put the links up. But I thought, you know, if you're interested in this group of people that I think are in some ways much maligned, two very interesting.
James's piece I've read, the one on Generation Gap, that was a great piece.
Really fantastic, where he kind of takes a sympathetic look at the post-80s where, you know, the conventional wisdom is that they're a useless bunch of brats with no morals. And he basically says, well, that's fine, but their parents generally are the
real
greedy,
turds,
materialistic, terrible people. Anyway.
Don't blame the kids, blame the parents.
Sure.
Yeah.
Alex's piece, what was that one? I like Alex's writing. It's very, very good.
It's also it's not. I don't remember where it is. We'll dig up the link and post
it
to the podcast.
My recommendation, actually, I'm making blind. Actually, not having read it yet, and I hope I don't live to regret this. But I'm going to recommend The Economist's section on the internet in China, trusting here that Gaudi and his colleagues, mostly Gaudi, by my understanding, did a good job on this. I believe it's something like 14 pages in the issue that should be out by the time you're listening to this podcast. So, yes, I am recommending Gotti Epstein's package. Okay. No, it's going to be great. A big package in The Economist on the China.
Good Gotti Epstein's big package.
Yeah, his big package. Gotti Epstein's got a big package. All right. Hey, thanks, Lori. That was great having you, man.
Thanks
good.
So much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You and David, as usual,
great to be back.
We will be back frequently. So, thanks for joining us, and we will see you next week. Take care.